Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Kimberly Motley is the only foreign litigator in all of Afghanistan. She is from Milwaukee, and she's been working in the country since 2008. She started her legal work as a public defender in the city of Milwaukee, and she discovered a program funded by the State Department to train and mentor lawyers in Afghanistan. She has represented Afghan women. She has taken on desperate cases. She has received death threats, has been accused of running a brothel, has had to move out of her house in Afghanistan because it was ransacked and electricity was cut off. She slept in her car for a month in freezing weather in December, and her response was, "It was good for me. It made me stronger." She's done a lot of work in the area of juvenile justice as a graduate of Marquette Law School, Master's of Science in Criminal Justice from UW-Milwaukee, and she has also trained in paralegal work from MATC. She joins us this hour to talk about her phenomenal cases, and we'll be welcoming phone calls for Kim as well. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, Twitter @KDunnShow. I should also say that she has trained hundreds of lawyers in Afghanistan as well. Hello, Kim. Thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, no. Thank you for having me.
And you also were featured in a TED Talk that was extraordinarily inspirational just a few days ago. My goodness, what a life you're having, huh?
Yeah, it's pretty busy.
Yeah, it is pretty busy. Let's start with Afghanistan and this case, and you'll tell us many cases during the course of the hour. But you brought, evidently, the first ever domestic violence case was brought before an Afghani court. You were the lawyer representing the young woman who had been beaten so terribly that you could tell that you were visibly moved in that TED Talk just talking about her. What happened?
Well, basically, for that particular case, Saha Ghul, she's one of my clients, and she was forced into an illegal marriage at the age of 12. Her brother sold her. And unfortunately, the family that she was, her husband as well as his family, were very cruel to her. And they wanted her to prostitute. And because she refused, they, you know, they tortured her. Mm. And, like, in unbelievable ways. I only really, you know, talked about the tip of the iceberg because I was, you know, I didn't want to get too deep into it. And so she endured this for months and months, you know, had been, you know, like I said, burned, beaten, chained in the basement, starved. And, you know, this is a strong young lady. I mean, she was refusing to prostitute, and she refused throughout the whole ordeal. And basically, finally, her family, you know, discovered her, and they went to the police to try to make sure that these people were prosecuted. And they were prosecuted initially, but after a year, they were quietly released because it got a lot of initial press, and I was not representing her at the time. And they were quietly released, and so I decided to represent her, and it's the first time that a woman who's a victim of violence had a lawyer that was representing her interest in court. And so because of that, they were rearrested, in addition to her brother, who was never prosecuted, and tried for that within the Afghan Supreme Court.
So essentially, really, you saved her life.
Well, I didn't save her. I mean, I didn't go in the house and get her.
Right.
You know, but, you know, she was at a very good shelter that was taking care of her. And, you know, luckily she had been taken out of that situation by other Afghans, her family members, who actually saved her life. I just helped her with her legal process.
Mm-hmm. You must be somebody who really stands out in Afghanistan. There just aren't American lawyers doing the kind of work that you're doing in that country. What do people say when they encounter you? Are they mad at you? What are you doing here? We can handle this on our own, or are they happy to see you, or what?
Well, I think I get mixed reactions. I mean, there aren't any other foreign lawyers that do what I do, so it's not just American lawyers. There's nobody else except
my
Afghans that litigate. So, yeah, I definitely stand out. Generally, the response has been very positive, which I'm grateful for. And, you know, I've gotten some negative response, but frankly, I don't really care about that because it's about my clients and it's about them being represented. And that's what I'm there to do. I'm there to represent my clients to the best of my ability within the Afghan legal system.
But you must have, this is not easy work for you to do and not an easy country in which to live. Why is it that you've stayed there? You could practice law anywhere in the United States. What draws you to Afghanistan?
Well, I mean, the thing about it is that there is such a need for justice in Afghanistan that it's just, I've never seen anything like it, you know, how the justice system works. And so, you know, the little slivers of help that I can give to the legal system, I'm happy to do it. And I'm happy to represent my clients the way that they deserve to be represented. And to be clear, you know, I don't just practice in Afghanistan. I practice in Afghanistan and in the U.S. I have some cases in Wisconsin. I practice in Dubai. I practice in the international criminal courts. So I practice in a lot of places. But Afghanistan is sort of, you know, obviously one of my main focal points of where I practice right now. But I'm looking to sort of expand this and my philosophy of really working the system from the inside out, especially in places where people just have a horrible legal system and lawyers that aren't willing to fight on their behalf.
Mm-hmm.
And so short answer is there's such a need for justice in Afghanistan that I felt compelled to get involved. And that's what, you know, initially got me interested and really what has kept me there.
You use this word, Kim, in the TED Talk, and I had to hear you say it twice before I realized what you were saying. It wasn't justice, it was justness.
Right.
What does that mean?
Yeah. Justness means to me is using the laws to protect. And I believe that the role of laws in society are to protect society. And so, you know, a lot of people, they're very disenfranchised by the legal system, and I can totally understand that. But I believe, and I've studied laws in many different countries, that there are a lot of really good laws out there that are underused. And by using those laws, we're creating a culture of justness within these legal systems, which is basically using the laws to protect people in the way that they're intended to be used. And so that sort of is my philosophy is raising the capacity of justness globally for people that are caught up within a legal system, whether they're being prosecuted, whether they're victims, you know, in commercial, civil, whatever. But I think it's very, very important.
This story made the front page of the New York Times a while ago involving a 6-year-old girl. Her father sold her for $2,500 to pay off a debt to another man in Afghanistan. Her fate, you say, had been decided in a jirga, and you participated in the second jirga. But what are jirgas, and are they indeed the real legal system in Afghanistan?
Well, I mean, Afghanistan is a very rural country, and so jirgas are used even more often than the formal justice system. And so they're just, jirgas are basically a form of mediation and arbitration, if you need sort of a frame of reference to what's used in the U.S. And with that case, I was really happy to be involved. And I just want to be clear, her father did not sell her off. The jirga decided against the father's wishes that he should give the girl up to satisfy the debt. He didn't want to do that. It was the judges, the religious leaders, and the mullahs who made this decision, and he tried to argue against that.
Mm.
But the ruling was he needs to give his daughter up.
Mm-hmm. And so what did you do about that?
Well, I got involved because there were several private donors that wanted to try to pay the debt. And, you know, it's not just that simple where you just pay this debt and it's okay. What needs to happen is there needs to be a second jirga, a jirga of appeals, to review the decision, to have everyone come and talk about it, which would include the elders, the mullah, the person to whom got the daughter, his father, as well, the person to whom, you know, Nagma's father owed the debt to, and also Nagma's father, all to agree to a second jirga, and for us to basically talk it all out. And I said, if I get involved in this jirga, then not only do I want to be there, but I want to be the presiding judge over this jirga. And so I had, you know, a lot of conversations with these men, and they agreed that, number one, I could be at the jirga, and number two, I could preside over the jirga. And so we had the second jirga, and the debt was satisfied, meaning the debt was paid, and the girl went back to her father, rightfully so. The engagement was terminated, and also I created a written contract where they all understood that what they had did was illegal, and if they did it again, they would be arrested for doing it. And I added some extra stuff because I felt like it was a good opportunity, that they all agreed that all their daughters have the right to go to school, that they agree that all their daughters have the right to choose who they want
goodness.
To marry when they become adults. And then I registered that with the government so that if any of them violate it, then they can all go to jail because that is a legally binding contract in Afghanistan.
My goodness, you really went the extra mile. Why did they let you in?
Well, I mean, I think that's just part of being a lawyer. You know, it's just, they're just comfortable with me because I think I'm a pretty nice person. And, you know, we had some great conversations and they were comfortable with me. And, you know, I wasn't coming in trying to, you know, do anything that I wasn't trying to be sneaky. I'm very upfront with things. And, you know, I know that that's respected. You know, I don't beat around the bush and, you know, I think I can say this because based on my cases that it's respected. And so that's part of the reason why they allowed for me to be in the Jirga. It was a respect thing, and it was a trust thing, too, mm-hmm. frankly. And thankfully, I'm glad that they did. You know, because for them to allow for me to be part of the Jirga, I'm getting a lot of good sort of feedback on that. But also, it was good on them, too. You know what I mean? To be that open-minded, to allow for me to be in that situation. And so it shows not only something different, but a change in attitude with them as well, which I think is an important point to highlight.
Absolutely it is. And what about the lawyers that you have trained in Afghanistan? Give us some background on maybe a dearth of lawyers in the country, and I guess your initial assignment was to train lawyers, and you've done that as well, haven't you?
I have. And, you know, I was with a justice program that was funded by the U.S. Department of State, and, you know, I was there to train lawyers and went around the country and trained lawyers, and frankly, I thought that program was not the best way to go forward. So, yes, I trained a lot of lawyers on their laws and on the sort of their laws. You know, there wasn't a lot of analytical thinking, and I'm very critical of that program, and I can be now because I really understand the legal system now. Mm-hmm. You know, then I didn't understand it. You know, when I went to Afghanistan, it was the first time I left the U.S. You know, I was being put in this situation where I'm training Afghan lawyers on their laws when I barely knew the laws myself. And, you know, what I see is a more effective way to train is to really do cases alongside lawyers, which now I can do that because I have the freedom to do that. But with that particular contract, I wasn't able to do that. But I feel like capacity building, the best way to capacity build, especially in places like Afghanistan, is to give them examples of how to do things. And that's what I try to do, and that's what I'm trying to spread, not just in Afghanistan, but also in other countries,
mm-hmm.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. It's really working the system from the inside out.
Well,
that's what really is effective.
Tell us more, a little more, Kimberly, about the system. There are some who would describe Afghanistan as terribly corrupt, filled with opium, a lot of trafficking going on in the drug trades, really a failed state. There are others who would say we're seeing the beginnings of democracy. I know that you've spoken about the new president. How do you describe, if you feel free in telling us, how you would describe the state? Do you see hope?
I do see hope, and I see hope because there is, I've seen since I've been in Afghanistan more lawyers practicing. When I first came there, people didn't really know what a lawyer was, what an advocate was, and I see people being more educated on that. I see that, you know, women's rights is getting more attention, which is a good thing, but people have to understand with women's rights, it's so abhorrent that the minimal steps that it has made, it needs to be really pales in comparison to what needs to happen. I've seen more judges that are females, which is a good thing. So I'm very optimistic. You know, I when I went to Afghanistan, I believe there are about 300 registered lawyers, and that's Afghan lawyers, and now there's over 1,000, which is great. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty good with, that happened within a six-year time period. But Afghanistan is so far behind. It's the number one most corrupt country in the world. And how I combat against that is I'm 100% ethical. I do not engage in corruption. I do not pay bribes. If I did those things, I would not have had the longevity of being there, I don't think. And I try to really lead by example, and I try to set realistic goals. You know, it's not my job to go to Afghanistan to change their legal system. It is my job to be in Afghanistan to represent my clients. And if I happen to be able to give a wider message to have to help other people, that's what I'd like to do. And so that's, you know, it's a very difficult place to practice. And I think the proof is in the pudding, you know, because I've been there for 6 years. I was the first Westerner to litigate in Afghanistan. I'm still the only Westerner that litigates in Afghanistan, and this is 6 years later.
Goodness.
Yeah, and I've tried to hire other foreign lawyers who, you know, they hear about what I do, and it's all cool and everything, but then they get on, and, you know, the longest I've had anyone last was 7 days, because it's no joke, you know, and it takes a lot to do these cases. I talk about the end results, but I don't really talk about what it takes to get there.
Well, what does it? Why do people quit after 7 days?
Well, because I think people get very scared. I think people don't believe me when I say I don't have security, and then when we start walking around, they realize that I don't have security. I think it's very scary for people to go to prisons, which I totally understand. And, you know, when you go to an Afghan prison, there's no guards there that are protecting me. You know what I mean? I'm in the pit and talking to my client. And I can't have anyone with me that's scared, because that weakens me. You know, because if you're in if people smell that fear, forget about it.
Right.
And so I think all those things, and in addition to that, you know, I'm working, you know, 15, 16, 17-hour days. You know, because I have so many cases, there's such a need, and, you know, my practice is so diversified that you really have to change from different, you know, levels, you know, because my practice is a for-profit litigious practice. So I do criminal work, I do human rights work, I do commercial work, I do civil work, and I also represent 4 embassies and ambassadors, and that's just in Afghanistan. That doesn't count my cases in the U.S. or my cases in Dubai. And, you know, with a lot of my international companies that I'm representing, I need to be on their different time levels. So I have companies I represent from Germany, the U.S., U.K., Japan, Korea, China, you know, South America, wherever. You know, it's just constant. And so I think a lot of people don't realize that. And they, from the outside, like looking at it, looks cool, but it's a lot of work. And
it sounds like it. Do you think that it's foolhardy of you on some level to not have security?
Well, I feel like security is a state of mind. And so I don't think it's foolhardy at all, because I'd like to think I have a certain level. I don't like to think. I know I have a certain level of street sense, which goes a long way. Even though I may not have a security person, I definitely have security measures in place that I take heed to when I need to.
And would it be fair to say or not that you got your street sense here in Milwaukee? You did.
Yeah, definitely. In Milwaukee. Milwaukee's rough, but yeah. I mean, I am a little bit mad at Milwaukee, to be honest. But
why?
Well, because this summer my husband was he came to Milwaukee. He was there for a tech high school reunion, and he was shot in the face.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Oh. And I had my daughter called me up at 3 a.m. when I was in Afghanistan.
Oh,
crying, telling me, and when my husband woke up, he was manacled to the bed. So I'm not really happy about Milwaukee right now, but I'm working through it. We have, I think you've heard about this big crime spree of robberies and whatnot.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, my husband was part of that. We're part of the reason why we've given a lot of attention to that, and luckily we have a good DA that's on the case. the politicians of Milwaukee have been very responsive, which I'm happy for. So I'm not completely mad at Milwaukee. But I think too many people in Milwaukee take things lying down, and victims have a right to be heard. And so this is another case where I'm representing my husband in the Milwaukee courts. And the following day, the person who shot my husband was caught trying to rob another lady, and then she had a carry concealed weapon license, and she shot him.
Oh,
so
my.
I'm representing her as well.
Oh,
so,
my.
Is
your husband okay, Kimberly?
Yes, he's okay, thankfully. Thank you for asking. He's actually in law school now, and he'll be graduating in 2 months. So he's doing very well, and I'm very proud of him being very outspoken on victims' rights in Milwaukee. He was actually there last week. I wrote an op-ed comparing Milwaukee to Afghanistan actually a couple months ago. And I was on the plane flying back from Afghanistan to Milwaukee when I wrote it.
Oh, Kimberly, you're living the life of 50 other people. I mean, it's you, but there are 50 of you. If not more than that.
I don't think anyone wants 50 of me.
We're going to take phone calls for you. Kimberly Motley, what a story. She's from Milwaukee. She's been in Afghanistan since 2008. She's the only foreign litigator in all of the country. She also works in many other countries throughout the world, and has received a lot of attention for bringing women's issues before the court, domestic violence issues. And she did say, and we'll ask her more about this, that some has been done concerning women's rights in Afghanistan, but there's a lot more to be done. So, of course, the follow-up question I need to ask is what needs to be done. Here's how you reach our conversation. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. The Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and you can also find us on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. To your participation in just one moment, this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for Kimberly Motley, and let's start with Richard in Madison. Hi, Richard.
Hi. First, I've got to say, I love public radio. What an amazing array of stuff you guys bring to us. But a question for your guest. And I may be a little naive maybe about the whole social structure in Afghanistan. How is it that you as a woman are accepted and they're not dismissing you? I heard what you said about not being corrupt and becoming the judge of this juror. But how is it that they would allow you, and would they allow their own women to do that, number one? And number two, is the respect that you've garnered, is there sort of a word that has gone out to ensure your security, to sort of say, you know, don't do anything to this woman, leave her alone, you know, we like her, we trust her, so on and so forth. And I just admire what you're doing. Good for you. Keep it up.
Yeah, great questions. Kimberly.
Well, thank you for your question. I definitely do get some level of protection from other Afghans, definitely. And I think I know the fact that I do so much pro bono work gets me so much respect within the communities. And I think I'm at a different situation in which I can, you know, preside over jurgas. I think the reason why I'm able to be in this situation is because I do things as Afghan men would do. For instance, I don't wear a headscarf, and I don't do that out of disrespect. It's just something that I just don't do, whereas most women do wear a headscarf. And not saying that's a bad thing. It's just not what I do. I shake hands with the men. You know, that's something that culturally a lot of women don't do or aren't allowed to do, but I do it. And I think, you know, and I'm able to participate in conversations with men. I mean, the legal practice in Afghanistan, and frankly the society in Afghanistan, is very male-dominated. And for 90%, if not more, of the meetings that I'm in, I'm usually the only woman that's in those meetings. And so I think because I'm in those situations, I think that's what helps make things more comfortable. And also, I'd like to think, I try not to come in very judgmental. You know, I try to come in really listening, but also being honest about what my thoughts are. And I think that's what's respected, that I'm very honest, that I'm very upfront, that if I think something is ridiculous, I say that's ridiculous. Like, for instance, Nagma, that's ridiculous. You know, and so I think people appreciate that, and not just in Afghanistan, but I think globally people appreciate if you're just, like, honest, if that makes sense.
It makes a lot of sense. Nothing like being honest. Thank you, Richard, very much for the call. And let me ask the young woman who was so terribly tortured. You talk about how it took you a long time to get her to open up. Let's talk about your clients and you how you get them to tell their stories. She was extremely reluctant at first, wasn't she?
Yes, she was. And, you know, that's part of being a lawyer. It's, you know, it's as a public defender, you're constantly doing clients. You're like, boom, 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 because you have so many cases to do. But you really need to, especially with these cases, be sensitive to your clients and have them talk to you when they're comfortable talking to you. And so with her, not only because she had been abused so badly, but also because she was a child, and I've done a lot of juvenile cases, you really have to give them their time to trust you, to talk to you, and then you start getting into their cases. And so it's sort of a psychological sort of exercise with my clients that I do where I try to get them to tell me stuff. And, you know, it takes a lot of – sometimes it may take one meeting. Sometimes it takes 10 meetings. But you just need to have the patience to be able to get that information and at the right time that the information should be given to you. And so with Sahar, it was really difficult, understandably, for her to give me that information, which I really needed if I wanted to represent her properly, because it was obviously so traumatic for her. And, you know, she was, I'm glad that she did give me that information. You know, it was hard, but we got through it.
It sounded like it was hard for you too, Kim.
Yeah, it was very hard. I mean, it's, you're dealing with a child. You know, I have three children. And especially when I'm dealing with, you know, I have Nagma, she's six. I have a daughter that's eight, you know, and I kind of, like, translate my kids into those situations. And so it's really difficult, you know, because it's one thing to talk about this case, but it's another thing to walk into a room and see this little girl in the physical state that she's in, and there's no way to explain why that happened to her. There's no justification to explain why that happened to her. And so it's really difficult, but it was just one of those cases where, and frankly with all my cases, I just have to, you know, swallow my own emotions because it's not about me, and I just have to get through it. I'm not there to cry with her. Mm-hmm. I'm there to try to help her legally. And so I feel like I work on anger a lot. But, you know, when I was giving my talk, you know, I'd practiced it a lot, whatever, and what was making me angrier, and I didn't really get fully angry, was when I was giving that talk, her picture was right in my face, you know. And so, like, as I was talking, I was looking up, and it just was making me madder and more angry. And that's why a lot of the times in that talk I was just looking down because I just couldn't. You know what I mean? Because it just brought back what I was feeling was with cases, there's moments for me. And the moment in that case was when I walked into the room and saw her. Like, that's a moment that just sticks with me.
Yeah.
And I'm reminded of that moment when I look at that picture.
Mm-hmm. Greg in Dodgeville. Hi.
Hello. Kim, I have a question about the State Department program by which you came to Afghanistan, and then a follow-up question on the jury at which you presided. I'm a lawyer in southwest Wisconsin, and 10 years ago or so, a lawyer at the public defender office in Lancaster left to practice law in Afghanistan, and she informed that it was through a State Department program. So it struck me as a coincidence. I thought, when in your introduction today on the program, I thought you were going to be Melinda Campos, but you're not.
Oh, I know Melinda. We're in the same program.
It occurs to me that you may know her if, you know, you're practicing there in Afghanistan. But I guess, not of much consequence. And then the follow-up question I had on the jury at which you presided, it sounds like you registered with the government a contract, and you said that in the future that would be enforceable by imprisonment. And that strikes me as curious that, you know, you the remedy for a civil contract violation is imprisonment. Is that the case?
Well, when you're doing a crime, it is. I mean, the parts that I put in the civil contract were, number one, you can't sell any of your daughters anymore. That's a crime in Afghanistan. Number two, your daughters can go to have the right to education, and that is a constitutional right in Afghanistan. If you deny anybody that right, that's a crime. And so that's how the civil contract had criminal sort of elements to it of if you do these things, that you understand that selling her is against the law. You understand that going to school is a constitutional right of women, and if you deny that right, that's against the law. You understand that a woman has a right to choose who they want to marry, and that's in Islamic law. So those are three criminal elements that were in that civil contract that if they violated, yes, they definitely can face crimes. The second thing is, with the U.S. Department of State Justice Program, you don't practice as a lawyer under that program because the U.S. State Department doesn't send people over to practice law because, frankly, American taxpayers rightfully so wouldn't want to pay for that. What we were sent there for was to train Afghan lawyers, and that's different, you know, obviously than practicing. It's just teaching. And I was in that program for a year, and after I left that program, after the first year, I registered a business, a legal consultancy firm, for lack of a better word, a law firm, and that's what I'm practicing under, is under my private law firm.
Hmm. Anything else, Craig?
Thank you.
All right. Thanks very much for your call. We have lines open if you want to join our interesting conversation with Kimberly Motley, 800-486-8655. She is the first foreigner to litigate in Afghan courts. She's been doing incredible work there, difficult work, and she's been doing it since 2008. And she's from Milwaukee. Our number is 800-486-8655. David in Madison, Kim, writes this. Please ask Kimberly about the language she uses in legal proceedings. Is everything going through translators? Are you learning the languages? Is English well understood?
I'm sorry?
Oh, I'm sorry. Did you miss that? The languages.
Yes, I did.
Okay, please ask about the language she uses in legal proceedings. Is everything going through translators? Are you learning the languages? Is English well understood?
Yeah, I'm sorry, yes. Basically, yes, I do work through translators. Everything that I do, I have translators that are there, and I do everything in writing, you know, in English and Dari. With a lot of times I represent other foreigners as well, so I may have a French client. And with that particular client, I'll submit documents in, you know, English, French, and Dari. So it depends on the client that I'm working with. It's a really international practice. But I learn the language by listening, but I'm not actively learning it, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
But I do work through translators, yes. But there are certain courts where I can speak English, but that's very rare. I just choose to do everything in the local language because I think that's respectful and that's what you should do. You should do it in their primary language.
You've also represented, and I believe one of these was a fairly high-celebrated New York Times reporter, journalists who have been forcibly exiled from Afghanistan.
Yes, Matthew Rosenberg. I represent the New York Times, and yes, I was representing him on that case.
And what was the background of that, Kim?
Well, basically, Matthew wrote an article that made some people in the former government angry. This was when President Karzai was in office a couple months back. And because he wrote this article, they were really harassing him. I mean, they were temporarily detaining him. But, you know, they called him down. They wouldn't let him leave. They questioned him. They were really harassing him. They were telling him he couldn't leave the country. You know, and it was absolutely ridiculous because there is freedom of the press in the Afghan Constitution. And so as a result of that, they then exiled him from the country, which, again, that also was illegal because there is an expulsion legal procedure that one goes through if you're actually expelled from Afghanistan. And that didn't happen with Matthew. They skipped a lot of steps. And what they did was, again, illegal. And so, you know, had meetings and talked to people within the government and got their legal acknowledgement that, in fact, yes, he was illegally exiled out of the country. Basically, it shouldn't happen. There is a procedure that should be followed if you're displeased with what a journalist writes in Afghanistan, and that's through the Ministry of Communication. That process was skipped. And so, long story short, the government under President Ashraf Ghani acknowledged that, you know, he has the right to be in Afghanistan, that there is freedom of the press in Afghanistan, and invited him back in the country. And now he's back in Afghanistan reporting.
Catherine in Eau Claire, our next caller. Hi, Catherine.
Hi, good afternoon. I just want to say I admire your work so much. I am a youngish woman, and I have a 9-year-old daughter, and I do a lot of work in the public and as a young leader in my community. And the question I have for you, Kimberly, is you are trying to affect change in the midst of competing agendas and multiple tensions that are going on. What type of advice or what kind of advice do you have for young people who are trying to affect change in the midst of multiple tensions and agendas and egos and differences? How do we play nice together and get good stuff done?
How do you play nice together? Well,
thank you. That's nice. That's a great question. What I would recommend for young people is that you listen and that it's okay if you have differing opinions. Everyone has a right to their opinion. Everyone has the right to be heard. And I think that it's healthy to have conversations with people that disagree with what you're saying. And frankly, I have conversations with people all the time that disagree with me. I think it's important to stand by what you believe in. I think it's important to understand that if you really want to affect change, it's not just one person that affects change. It takes multiple people to do that. And so you have to have somewhat of a collaborative mindset if you really want to affect change from a long-term basis. And for young people that really want to affect change, you have to understand that it's not about you. You know, that you have to be selfless in what you do and understand that you're going to get some hits and you're going to get some negativity on what you were doing, especially affecting change, because people don't like that a lot of times. But you have to be strong. And if what you're doing you believe is the right thing to do, then, you know, you're just going to have to power through it.
That's a great answer. Do you want to talk about what it is you're trying to change, Catherine?
Well, I serve on the city council in Eau Claire, and I'm the youngest female and the first Latina elected in the greater community. So, you know, and it's a lot of quite honestly, cutting through just perceptions that people have about young people. About, you know, I was told when I was first interested in public leadership that young women like me don't have a place in local government, that we're just about, the cities are just about budgets and sidewalks, and I certainly beg to differ. I've been elected for, or serving for over 2 years and elected for, I was appointed and then won a seat to serve for a 3-year term. And so just really cutting through multiple perceptions. And then also, you know, Kimberly, what you talk about is this collaboration, is that there are so many people working to get things done. And I think that a lot of times in leadership roles, whether it's elected or appointed or in private or, you know, any types of organizations, that sometimes people try to be a leader to be a hero instead of saying, how can I work within the system and how can I do my piece to help affect change? And so it's, I think it's noble work, and I love it. It's exhausting, and I also love it at the same time. But I think it's, you know, there's always things that we can learn about leadership, and I especially look to other women to teach where I can learn, you know, lessons on how to affect change in the midst of multiple tensions. One of the people that I really greatly admire is the Undersecretary of State. Her name is Rose, and I can't pronounce her last name very well, but Gotemeyer. Anyway, she is the one who negotiated the New START Treaty with the Russians, and I met her a couple years ago in D.C., and I said, what do young women need to know about negotiation? Like, what can you teach us? And she said, you always work to build trust across differences. Always, 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 no matter what. Because when you have trust, you can more effectively affect change. And I just heard a quote recently that trust grows, or no, excuse me, collaboration grows at the speed of trust. Mm. And so you can't collaborate without the trust. And they're so connected. So appreciate all the work that you're doing. And when you feel your moments of frustration and you hit the walls, know that there's lots of people in the world cheering you on and who appreciate your work and who are also trying to change the world in their pockets, too. So go get them.
I appreciate you, too. I used to live in Eau Claire, so I understand the Eau Claire. I went to Eau Claire for a couple of years.
Oh, you did?
Good for you. I did. Hmm. That's where I met my husband, so yeah.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, you two of you should meet sometime. Thank you for the lovely call, Catherine. That was just terrific. You've been everywhere, Kimberly.
Yeah.
You've just been everywhere. We welcome more phone calls. Well, let's take one now before we pause, and then we'll get to more. Corey in Watertown is next. Hi, Corey.
Hey, how's it going? Thank you for taking my call.
Sure, Corey.
My question, first of all, I really admire this lady. She's an incredible person, an incredible human being to be able to go to different countries all over the world and practice law. My question is, commented that Afghanistan is one of the most corruption-filled places in the world. I would like to know, do you think it's easier to practice law in these corrupt societies or in somewhere like America where a clerical error can get a criminal off? I'd appreciate your answer on that.
Thanks, Corey.
All right, thank you. Well, I think it's definitely more difficult to practice law in Afghanistan. And the reason being is because everyone always has their hands out. I mean, everything is sort of me trying to funnel through corruption, from going to see my clients in the prison, people want to get paid, going to get documents for my clients, people want to get paid, you know, trying to get a court date, judges want to get paid. It's just ridiculous how many times I have to say no. Huh. But luckily I have kids, and when you're a parent, you learn saying no is easy. And so... But it's so difficult. I mean, it's so difficult because they're really, it's the only place that I've been to where procedure, unwritten procedure trumps written law. So if they've been doing the same wrong thing for years and years and years, but legally it says these are the steps, a lot of times they're still like, well, this is what you're supposed to do with this procedure. You know, and it's absurd, you know, and so I find that, you know, with cases that go to trial, I'm spending hundreds and hundreds of hours before they even get to trial. I'm asking for things in writing that I shouldn't have to ask for. For instance, I routinely send letters to judges saying, hey, could you please let us know when the court date is? And my client would like to be in court, so if he could please be transported from the prison, that'd be great. Or writing, you know, my client would like to speak in court, even though they have a right to speak in court, right to confrontation. And so I find that Afghanistan is frankly, a lot more difficult to practice law than the U.S. For various reasons. The U.S. definitely has its difficulties as well, but it's really, really different. It really is something like I've never seen.
Kimberly Motley is our guest this hour, and Kimberly is the only foreign litigator in all of Afghanistan. She started her own law firm there, Motley Legal Services. Look her up and listen to her TED Talk this week. It's just fascinating. You spell her last name Motley. She is from Milwaukee. She has worked as a public defender in this city. She worked with a program funded by the State Department to train and mentor lawyers in Afghanistan. She's represented Afghan women. No Western woman has litigated for them before in the courtroom. She's taken on desperate cases. It's been very difficult work. She doesn't have bodyguards. She's received death threats. She's been accused of running a brothel. At one point, had to move out of her house. And she's done a lot of work in the area of juvenile justice. She was an attorney with the state of Wisconsin's Public Defender's Office, where she litigated hundreds of criminal, civil, and juvenile cases, misdemeanor cases, and also felony as well. So we're concentrating on her work in Afghanistan, but feel free to go elsewhere in the minutes that remain of this show. Here is how you reach us. The phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page, where you can also like us and you'll get updates on what it is we're talking about next, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at @KDunnShow. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we go back to phone calls for Kimberly Motley. Our next caller is Allison in Racine. Hi, Allison.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call. I felt compelled to call and just express my admiration for Kimberly. I got a big smile on my face when I heard that she attended UW-Eau Claire. I am also a graduate of UW-Eau Claire, and I just wanted to say thank you to her for representing women and more broadly Americans and showing that there are many of us who respect the laws and cultures of other countries. And I wanted to read a quote to her that maybe she's familiar with. It's from Benjamin Franklin, and he said, "What you would seem to be really." And I think she's living those words. She just seems like an incredible woman and human being. So thank you for your work, Kimberly.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Allison, so much for your call. Yeah, Josh in La Crosse. Hi, Josh.
Hello, Kathleen. How are you?
All right. How are you, Josh?
Pretty good.
Thanks.
Hey, I just had a quick question for Kimberly. I've read some articles over the last few years talking about how there's an abundance of attorneys going through law school in the States, and you know, it used to be the surefire white collar job, and now it's not. And I was a Marine for 10 years, and I've been to Iraq a couple times, and I just was overwhelmed with emotion when I heard what Kimberly's doing, because I understand how much of a risk that is to herself. You know, you've got kids. I mean, this is an incredible level of sacrifice. And I just want to hear what the future is for practicing law from a person who's doing it for selfless reasons.
Thank you. Well, basically what I would like to do is I would like to raise the capacity of the rule of law globally and really create a global human rights environment. And so what my intention is to go to different countries and to continue to try to be an example and to continue to try to work with local lawyers or work, you know, myself in representing clients. For instance, before this year is up, you know, obviously I'm going back to Afghanistan, but I'm going to check out Africa, meaning the continent of Africa, but I'm also going to check out Uganda and hopefully Rwanda and maybe Burma and see what's going on there. Because I think it's important. I think it's important that people become less disenfranchised to the law and to understand that the law is for all of us and it's for us all to benefit from. And I understand that there's cases out there where it just doesn't look like justice was served. But I think that it's important that people, we bring it back where people understand that the law is for us and that we need to use it in the best way possible to achieve that justness for not only just ourselves, but also to the wider society. And so that sort of is my plan, is to just backpack it and just go to different countries in addition to Afghanistan and just rock court around the globe if I can and help people. We'll see what happens.
Hmm. A caller wants to know, Kimberly, if you're writing a book, this caller says you need to get this story out.
I am working on a book, but it's so hard because I'm so busy.
It sounds like
so,
it. Right.
Yeah, so it's like, technically I am writing a book, but I can't say when it's going to be out.
Somebody needs to help you do that. And what about your family? Did they ever go with you to Afghanistan?
Well, I mean, my husband, he did come to Afghanistan for a little bit, and my kids don't. But, you know, he didn't, it was just different. He didn't really like it,
uh-huh.
And I understand why. And part of the issue he had, which I totally understand, is it just really affected him how the women were treated there.
Uh-huh.
He really didn't like that. But generally, no, my kids don't come to Afghanistan with me.
Yeah. Well, you're something. Thank you so much for being with us, and I hope we're having this story go out even further as a result of people hearing this. Kimberly, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Our pleasure. Kimberly Motley, it's M-O-T-L-E-Y. She gave a TED Talk, which was on just a couple days ago, so you may want to Google that and listen to what she has to say. She is the only foreign litigator in all of Afghanistan. She started her own law firm there, Motley Legal Services. She's from Milwaukee. She's been a public defender in the state of Wisconsin. And what a remarkable story. Thanks to Scotty Myers for finding her for this interview. And thanks to Scotty as well for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. News is coming up. And then Central Time, we'll be with you again on Monday for All Things Political at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. Thanks for listening.